Hello and welcome to the third podcast of the Queensland Gardening Hour, starring Jerry Colby-Williams.
Good morning.
Noel Burdett.
Good morning.
And me, LJ Stockwell. So nice to have you back. Now, boys, I was wondering, I think we should first of all get started with what have you been doing in your garden?
Well, I've followed up on last program and I've finished my weeding and I'm now into mulching. I'm getting ready for the dry weather of spring because at the moment, while it is nice and cool, the evaporation is quite slow. But as soon as we get into September, the weather's going to warm up and things will dry out really quickly. So a nice nurturing layer of mulch is going down in the garden.
All right. Well, talk me through that, because if people are out there and they're getting rid of all their weeds now, that you've got a minute, haven't you? Things don't grow back as fast as they
Absolutely.
Do normally. So should you be applying some fertiliser first?
Well, it's not much point adding fertiliser if plants aren't growing. And it depends what you're dealing with as to whether you feed or not. So in the vegetable garden, I'm giving plants a gentle feed with liquid seaweed, and I water that on or spray that on the leaves. But with trees and shrubs, which are dormant, I just put down the mulch and I will feed them later on when they start to wake up into spring.
Oh, so what mulch are you using?
At the moment, I'm using chopped sugarcane in the back garden. I think that's the best overall mulch because you can vary the thickness. The reason I use it so much is because when I first moved into my garden, I had worm-free soil. And anybody that gardens knows that if soil is suitable for worms, it's generally suitable for plants. So I had to convert that. And one of the things that I've done is instead of just having a little worm farm, where I just literally grow a little bit of worm juice and a little bit of compost from them, I treat the whole of my garden as a worm farm. And chopped organic sugarcane used all through the vegetable garden means that wherever that is laid, the worms will be. They love feeding on it.
That's amazing, Jerry. So do you literally bought worms into a bed once you've
sugar-caned it? Look, the composting worms that we use in our gardens are not native. They only live in the leaf litter and the mulch layer or a compost heap. They won't dig down. They're not real earthworms. So if you want to start them up, you've got to buy them in, which can be quite expensive, but you can go to hardware stores and get them, or you can borrow them from somebody else or a community garden where they have a compost heap that's already got some of those worms. You just grab 50 or so, put them in your garden, and as long as you've got enough material for them to feed on, they will breed and spread throughout the garden.
And then do they just stay there all the time, as long as there's food there?
They move a little bit. So as the weather cools down in autumn, you get a lot of worm casts as they tunnel a little bit deeper into the soil so they avoid the cold weather because the surface of the soil is quite cool. But just all they have to do is go down about 30 centimetres and everything is perfect down there. So they do have some seasonal variations, but basically they are active all the time.
Jerry, I learn something new about you every week. So now we know that Jerry lives in a giant worm farm. I didn't know that before. And what about you, Noel? What have you been getting up to in your garden?
Well, I've been continuing to do my pruning as I was doing last time. That's never ending for me. I'm constantly doing the pruning, catching up on that sort of work.
Is that because you've got so many perennials?
It is and it isn't. I have lots of trees and shrubs in my garden that I need to sort of maintain, you know, the shade element, because I've come to the realisation that if I let a lot of these smaller trees grow up too big, then they're going to cut out the light factor, and that changes the whole aspect of what I can plant in certain areas. So by pruning things back, it sort of let me see the light once again and opened up certain areas for me to plant new plants in there, which is great. But I know they'll come back to life. This is the whole point. Pruning many of these trees and shrubs in the wintertime is a good thing to do while they're dormant.
So do you prune with a chainsaw?
No, I don't go that far.
I had a mate who pruned with a chainsaw and the trees loved it.
Yeah, I don't go that heavy-handed. I have a pruning saw which I use, which is perfectly enough for me. Mm-hmm. And then I have extended pruners that I can get up into the trees and all that sort of thing, because some things just don't stop growing. So I need to sort of, you know, correct that. Things such as jacarandas at the moment are still actively growing in my garden.
And the lily pillies are shooting. Have you noticed? Or mine are, anyway.
Yeah, they are. We've had a lot of warm weather lately. But I've been doing the pruning. I've been doing mulching just like what Jerry has. I've also been planting a few extra bits and pieces, a few special things in my garden that are coming up at the moment. I've been nurturing some very tender plants that I've growing now for the second year through. And, of course, it's always a joy to go out there and give myself that opportunity to just enjoy the garden for what it's providing me.
It's your happy place.
It is.
Hey, Noel, it would be a good time for anyone then to get their hedges into shape, wouldn't it?
Yes, you can get them a light prune now if you wanted to, towards the latter part of winter, just a light prune. But, of course, they will start. Always best to prune them, I think, when they can respond sooner than later.
Oh, yeah.
So I would probably wait towards the early part of spring to give them a nice light prune and then feed them at the same time, give them a good mulching, and then you'll see a brilliant response.
What about if you want to give them a really vicious prune?
Depending if they're really out of control, then certainly you need to bring them back into control. Because, look, every guy out there knows what I'm about to say. It's all about control, guys, in the garden. When you get out there with your pruners and your saws, your secateurs, your chainsaws, it's all about the control.
It's about dominating the garden.
So certainly you can go out there, and if you need to do that, you can, but don't expect to see a great deal of fast growth coming on immediately. It'll take a little bit of time because the weather and the soil, especially the soil, hasn't completely warmed up at this point. Okay, but if you do wait a few more weeks, you can just go for it, LJ.
You have to be careful with pruning certain species of hedge, though, because at the moment, one of my joys is I've got Phillip Island hibiscus as a hedge in the front garden, and it's one of Australia's rarest wildflowers, and it flowers in winter, so it's in bloom at the moment. And so I do my heavy prune only once a year, because if I do it more than once a year, then I remove flower buds.
Do that when it finishes?
Yes,
flowering.
I do. So I prune it in spring, and then I let it get rather shaggy during summer and autumn, because I know that if I keep it neat and crisp, then it will look lovely but green. And the flowers are the attraction to this particular hedge, because they are rather pretty. They start cream, they fade pink, and they bring in birds and bees. So there's quite a lot of activity, and it does look quite cute when it's blooming.
And I do know that when it's in flower, it's a real talking point in your garden. It's quite an eye-catching feature in the front garden too. Something else with the pruning, if you do prune a lot of lily pillies now, you've got to be very careful with lily pillies, because the psyllid season starts at the beginning of spring. And most lily pillies get all those little bumps and lumps over the new leaves.
Are they the things living down in the mulch underneath?
They're mites, basically, and they just move from plant to plant. Uh-huh. But if you encourage far too much soft, sappy, sweet growth on your lily pillies, you're also going to encourage a major infestation of psyllids on your lily pillies. And although there are lots of lily pillies out there that say they don't get them, they get them. Okay, so this is something you need to be wary about, is over pruning, getting too much soft growth. So if you do prune your lily pillies, prune them a little bit but more often, and then look at protecting them along the way, because the psyllid outbreak starts from the beginning of September and goes right through till about late November. Then there's a little bit of a break in the summer, and they start again late summer into the autumn. So there's two major times that you do need to protect them against the psyllids.
Two psyllid seasons.
Well, boys, when I tell people about our podcast, they always say, I've got questions I'd like to ask. So people are sending them through on the Facebook page. Have you boys got any questions this week?
We do.
I've got an interesting one here, which I didn't expect to get, from Monique in Tinbiwa. And she says, I've just started a boutique horticultural business growing edible flowers and herbs, and would like to see whether it's possible to eat pentas flowers. Now, pentas are quite a common perennial. I haven't heard anything about them being toxic, but I can't actually recommend that you eat them, just in case there is some sort of thing in there. Like violas, pansies are quite edible, but the leaves can affect people with heart conditions, so you've got to be very careful how many of them you actually eat. So a few violas is fine, too many can cause problems if you've got a weak heart. So what I've recommended to Monique is that she gets hold of a copy of a book called Australia's Poisonous Plants, Fungi and Bacteria by Dr. Ross McKenzie, and that's published through CSIRO Books, and it was printed in 2012. That is the most comprehensive book on toxic plants in Australia. And it will also advise not just on what's toxic to humans, but also animals, pets. So it's a very useful reference. Not cheap, but I think if you're going into business and you're selling edible flowers, you really got to have a reference book like that at your disposal.
Mm. Sounds good. What about you, Noel?
Well, I've got a few doozies, actually. I'll start with one of them. This one is from Helen from Ashgrove. Now, this is a very common problem that I've come across on over the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that it's still happening, to be honest with you. Helen writes, a few years ago, we bought a standard fig for a potted feature at the front door. And over time, it had dropped most of its leaves and there's a bunch of bare branches. So you know what the outcome of that probably has been. Well, while I was out one day last summer, my husband, not the gardener in brackets, decided to plant it in the garden near the front veranda.
Uh-oh.
Okay, so you know what I'm probably getting to do. Since then, it has put on lush new growth and is looking like it's making a full recovery. I use sea salt on it every 2 weeks, or seaweed. And in saying that, I have reservations about this, but my husband, Dennis.
Not the gardener.
Has assured me that by keeping the top section pruned, that the root system will also remain smaller and pose no threat to the house.
I think Dennis needs to...
Is this true? Now, Dennis, I have to say, this is purely an old husband's tale. Okay? Because this is something that has occurred over and over and over again. It was even covered on television many times. Pruning the top of a very vigorous species such as Ficus benjamina, which is most of them are what's sold today, or Ficus hillyi, does not restrict the root growth. It's like saying, if I take my five-year-old child and have a haircut, maybe its feet won't grow. Well, that doesn't happen. Okay, so the root systems are very, very strong. They can easily get under the foundations of the home. And, and something so incredibly dominating, such as a fig of ficus of that form, can really cause problems to the foundations of that house.
And there were a lot of them around, weren't there? Because do you remember was it during the 90s that sort of shaped little ball topiary?
That's right. This is what they bought, initial standard or topiarised ficus. Yes. They look very attractive. They are best kept in large pots at that stage. And what tends to happen is because they are strong and resilient, when they drop all their leaves from lack of sunlight, lack of water, whatever it might be, because they're living on a veranda, people think, oh, I've spent so much money on it, I don't want to just throw it away. And it might look pretty in the garden. So they pop it into the garden, and yes, the plant recovers miraculously well, especially during the summer months. So this is obviously what's occurred.
So what should you do if your topiary is looking a bit crook?
Well, basically, you need to take it out of the pot. You need to scrape down the sides of the root system. Give it a bit of a light prune. You can be really savage to these plants, and they come back remarkably well. But then try and look at repotting it. If you have a large pot that it was in, repot it back into that pot with fresh potting mix. So all around the edge of the potting mix, give it a brand new lease of life, but keep it in a sunnier position and remember to water it. Now, those two things bear in mind a one option, but you may end up getting a few other problems as well, like curl grubs. So you do need to remember to water the plant regularly, keep some extra nutrition there because it's quite a hungry feeder when it wants to be.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, it needs room to develop the root system. So people often go for those really small pots, those V-shaped pots that they put at the front door because it looks aesthetically pleasing but not conducive for growing plants such as those ficus species. So I would suggest, Helen, that you take it out of the ground one day and you put it back into a larger pot, maybe something like a half wine barrel, and keep it in the sun, and I'm sure you'll be able to enjoy it for years
and
to come.
And then get Peter, not the gardener.
Dennis.
And rub his nose in it.
No.
Dennis, look at this.
But certainly it's something worthwhile considering. And if he's unaware, you live in Ashgrove. There's a lot of older homes in Ashgrove that have these ficus species in their garden. Yeah. So take a trip around the streets and see. Point them out to him. If not, take him to New Farm Park. There's a really fine example there of fully grown ficus and what they can do to your garden.
Listener.
Let's have a look at a few more listeners' questions. Have you got one, Jerry?
I had a very interesting one from Isabel Gryan. She's a new gardener, so she's never experienced a lot of the things we take for granted. She's planted a mulberry tree, and she's noticed that it's fruited three times in the last year, but it's still got its own its leaves. It hasn't lost any of its leaves in winter. And she said, well, what's going on? People have told me I've got a weird mulberry. The answer really is that mulberries are opportunistic. So in a cold climate, say if you were in Canberra, you would only get one crop a year because summer is quite brief. And that is the classic behaviour of a mulberry. But if you move it to a warmer climate, like the subtropics, and the weather is relatively warm, you can get more than one crop in a year. This is not a problem for the tree. It's certainly not a problem for the gardener. It's just that they are opportunistic plants. And I think what she's catching, and which is I find quite interesting, is that despite the fact that we've had a couple of cold snaps this winter has generally been quite mild, and we had a very long, consistently warm autumn. And this is the fourth year in a row that we've had this. So some plants are behaving unusually. And this term, the response of a plant to changing environmental stimuli, is known as phenology. So we have a novice gardener who's experiencing active phenology occurring in her garden. So she's fine. She's got no problems at all there.
Could I just add, I suspect that what she's also got is one of the newer self-pollinating cultivars.
Could well be.
And because of that, it's a lot easier for the tree to then form the fruit, whereas a lot of older gardens, and I'm included in this one, I actually have a female tree in my garden and my neighbour has a male tree. That means the only way you could get mulberries in the past was if you bought the individual trees. So just like the old pawpaws.
Yeah.
Okay, so my female tree only provides fruit but once a year, which starts around late August, early September, goes for about 6 weeks if the birds don't get them first, and then that's it. And then it's just foliage for the rest of the year. So a lot of people would say, well, I don't understand the reason why, and that's more likely because the newer forms on the market are all self-pollinators.
And interestingly, my neighbour's mulberries are completely leafless and my two are completely in leaf. They haven't dropped any leaves at all, so they still think it's autumn.
Interesting. It doesn't help when you have the heat of blowing on in your garden, does it, Jerry?
And what about you, Noel? Do you have another question?
Yeah, I do. This is from Kylie. Kylie on the Sunshine Coast. Now, she said, hi, Noel. Will deciduous magnolias grow in our climate? She lives on the Sunshine Coast. I've been told not to bother and only stick with the port wine magnolia and such, but I love the look of the tulip-shaped forms. I did buy one, however, from the Queensland Garden Expo at Nambour recently, but I was given no advice. That's a bit of a shame that you weren't given the advice, Kylie, especially since you did buy one from there. And what she refers to are those beautiful, picturesque, romantic blooms that you see on the front covers of gardening magazines with beautiful tulip-shaped blooms on deciduous trees and shrubs. Purely denuded of foliage, but just the flowers are holding up towards the latter part of winter. And that is something that people tend to connect with cooler climate gardens. Now, in saying that, yes, you can grow the deciduous forms of magnolias here in southeast Queensland. The trick with that is to connect with the right forms. Any ones that have their heritage with breeding in New Zealand, forget about. But these other forms, the plain old Solangianas, are the most respectable forms to grow. In fact, I was only passing one the other day at Inala, and in the front garden, they've had one there for years and years and years. It's in full bloom. And I have seen them around the traps. I've grown them myself. My old boss, Bruce Perrott, used to actually grow them as well in his front garden. And, of course, you can grow them. But the other thing to remember when you're planting a deciduous form of magnolia is that pick the spot and pick it well. It will not take to being transplanted if you don't like where it is. It'll sulk or it'll die. If you move it around, it It's not as an absolute no-no. They like slightly acidic soil with a once-a-year application of gypsum for the calcium uptake. They just really like that. And that's really about it. And you can also grow them in large half-wine barrels, but I would probably be planting them in an area where they get protected from hot afternoon sun and strong wind. So a little bit shady, but that would be perfect for them.
On the south side?
On the south side, but depends. With the people, with the way we're living today in close proximity to other homes and that, you know, we're finding that there's a lot of shade and protection coming from our neighbours' homes as well.
True. And now it's time for What's in Jerry's Jars?
Well, this week it's been turmeric harvesting for me.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody actually wrote in to me through Facebook and said, I've grown turmeric, I've got an enormous crop, what on earth do I do with it? So I've recommended he uses there's a Rajasthani curry dish which is based on turmeric, so he can use quite a lot of that.
Chair, can I just interrupt for a second? Sorry, non-gardener. Turmeric, so are we talking about a bulb or something?
Yes. Look, it's a winter herbaceous perennial, so it's a nice, lush, leafy plant during summer.
Oh, yeah.
It grows during the warm, wet season, dies down to the ground in autumn, and it produces small little bulbs which are turmeric coloured, so they've got a sort of saffron colour to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the bulbs would not really be much more than the size of a small finger to a thumb. That's about the size. They're quite small, but they produce large clusters of them, and they do that with quite easily.
Uh-huh.
So you produce quite a lot for the amount that you plant.
And how would you manufacture something? What do you use it for?
Well, I make the turmeric powder by digging them up, brushing the soil off, washing them, peeling them. I boil them first.
Oh, yeah.
After I've washed them, boil them for about 40 minutes. Then I peel them. Then I put them through a processor to slice them very quickly and thinly.
Oh, yeah.
Put them on a baking tray in the oven, dry them out, grind them up in a mortar and pestle, and you've got turmeric powder. And that is what I use to make what I brought along here, just for you to have a try. Now, this is turmeric cake, which has got sugar in it. And it's got some gluten in it because there's a little bit of flour in there. But it's basically a vegan cake. And turmeric is the thing that's coloured it and flavoured it.
So it's got quite a yellow colour.
There's coconut, there's almonds on the top, and it's quite a runny sort of batter type of cake, which is something I generally don't make a lot of. Normally I go for traditional cakes with
cream
with
and
egg.
Butter and sugar and everything.
And there's no fat in this either. There's no butter in it as well. But it is a very nice cake.
Where did you find the recipe?
I got the recipe online originally, but then I modified it because I like to put some cardamom in because that enhances the flavour just a little bit. And I do like to use almond milk in it as well because that sweetens the cake. So a lot of the sugar that you taste in there is actually the sweetness from almond milk. But it's just a nice little way of serving it, other than in a curry or for colouring rice. And I like using the turmeric to colour rice because, again, if you've got guests coming around, they often appreciate the colour in the rice. I mean, it just tastes the same, pretty much the same.
So you'd use that
powder.
Just
looks different, and somehow, in other people's opinion, it looks more professional.
Yeah, right.
And so I like that little trick. That's all.
And can you use the actual vegetable as, would you use it in a curry before you've done the whole powder process?
You can, yes. You can just clean the roots, slice them up thinly. It's a bitter flavour, so quite often you'll find them in relishes, chutneys, things like that. But it's quite nice, and if I add it as a vegetable, I'll slice it very thinly and put that in with the rice, so it'll colour and cook with the rice.
I think turmeric's got quite a medicinal.
Oh, yes.
Turmeric is actually classified as one of the world's superfoods.
And
it's quite incredible. It has lots of antibacterial properties, antifungal properties, anti-cancer properties. It actually is an incredible thing to have. It's an amazing thing to add to your food if you are suffering from diabetes. It can actually do a lot of good things for your blood. So I use turmeric all the time, and Jerry has seen me use it up on stage there. And of course, being of Sri Lankan origin, turmeric is something that I've grown up with as part of my kitchen pantry. It has to be there regardless. There's no question if buts or maybes. It's there. I don't often make the likes of turmeric cake because I use turmeric a lot. And like you, Jerry, I've been harvesting mine as well. It's just wonderful to know you can just go and grab your own turmeric from the shelf that you've actually grown yourself and use it up in your cooking. And I try and put it into lots of things. I've made a distilled tea with it, and
I love the tea.
Yeah, and it's also that tea can actually be used in your rice as a liquid as well. It's another way of actually infusing the rice a little bit longer with the juice.
When I make the tea, I use the leaves and a little bit of the root, boil that in water for about 20 minutes, and then I add a little bit of honey and a little bit of lime juice, and that makes a really refreshing tea. So you can actually use it while the plant is in active growth and those roots are starting to fatten. Mm-hmm. They're starting to fill up. So you can harvest it all year round. And another thing that when people grow turmeric for the very first time, they're often surprised when it flowers because the flowers are really beautiful. And while you can't eat the whole of the spike, the individual flowers in the spike can be pulled out and they can be eaten. They can be iced and they can be used in salads as well.
That's right. It actually has wonderful landscaping properties for a garden, for anyone who loves a tropical style garden. Mm. Because being a member of the ginger family, it really lives up to that expectation.
Oh, right.
And it can grow down as far as Victoria, but you need to keep it in a warmer position. So for those people down in cooler areas that just hanker after that tropical look in a garden, this is a great way of getting that really exotic looking plant.
And Noel, I noticed that you have brought in a truly spectacular collection of flowers.
Well, this is what happens when one goes out to the garden to pick one variety of flower only, because I'll talk about that later. But I went out and picked a few things from the garden because it might be winter here in Brisbane, but my garden doesn't know about it because it's in full bloom. It's got flowers scattered all over the place. And if they were in one tiny courtyard garden, it'd be a flurry of colour, but it's just scattered all over. The colour comes from trees, it comes from perennials, it comes from shrubs.
Pretty beautiful thing here? This looks like what is it?
It's a dombaya.
It's a dusky pink.
Well, actually, in the garden, it's a beautiful deep cherry pink colour, Dombaya cucumium, and it's known as winter's joy for obvious reasons because it smothers itself.
Well, I just want to describe it so people know. Mm. It's sort of got about 6 or 7 petals and then a very long white stamen in the middle of it. That's really spectacular. It's in a big cluster of probably 14 or so flowers.
They look a bit like hydrangeas in a way, don't they?
They look a bit like a loose giant hydrangea. Mm. Yes, you're right. Mm. The leaves look a little bit like a maple tree, This is a very large tree, though. It's a very rounded tree. It's smothered at the moment. The birds absolutely adore this tree. And underneath is carpeted, the floor is carpeted with all these flowers that have finished and have fallen, and when they fall this colour, and then they dry a beautiful soft shade of pink.
Oh, how
pinky
lovely,
dust colour. Just a really delightful thing. And of course I've got roses in the garden, and something that brings me a lot of joy during the winter time when the flowering peaches are in bloom. That's a plum. That always takes me right back to my childhood. It has its own perfume that is distinct. The flowering peaches are all in bloom right now. These are all come up from self-sown babies that I transplanted from my original ones. And, of course, perfume is something that is quite strong in the wintertime here. So you've got the likes of perennial Thai basil looking absolutely amazing. The bees love this one. This one here, which is your fruity sage, your Salvia dursiana. And, of course, it smells so sweet and perfumed. You've got something a little bit more spicy like the Tagetes lemoni here, which is bright golden flowers, and the native stingless bees love this one. And, of course, my favourite, my very, very favourite of all of them right now, because my favourite changes every day.
Yeah, of course. Today's favourite.
Yeah, is this one here, which is a Buddleia. And this is Buddleia asiatica. It's unlike any of the other Buddleias that are sold on the market. It has the most sweetest, softest, delicate perfume, just like freesias. Have a smell of that, LJ.
Through my cold, I'll smell it.
Oh,
Noel, you are such a good gardener.
It is very
Look
sweet.
At that.
Oh, you don't have to be a good gardener to experience these flowers. You can actually just get them and grow them in your own garden. And that's the whole point. It's just so that you've got this excitement, this change of season happening. There's even a daffodil in there. I've got pots of daffodils that are going to come up. Irises are just starting. And this is the sort of thing that I think really is important and fun.
Well, now, while we're rummaging around in Noel's drawers, you know, Noel, you are the person
who's... That's a scary place.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Because there's a lot of cooking implements in there that you haven't used for a while. And now you are the person who's taught me about using spices.
Well, thanks, LJ. That's nice to know. I love my spices, as you know. I've been doing a little bit of cooking at home, but more so I've been doing some cooking demos with my cousin Valerie.
So this is really using your Sri Lankan heritage to teach people about how to use spices.
Yeah, we like to share that whenever we have the opportunity to do so. And that was recently done at the Queensland Garden Expo at Nambour.
Oh, yeah.
So we were cooking up a bit of a storm, a spicy storm, so to speak.
Is Valerie a fun girl?
Valerie's lovely, yes. She's a dear cousin.
I had a bit of fun listening in. I actually had a gap in my schedule so I could see both of you in action. and you know, there was a real spark going on there. And the one thing that's missing at the moment is that the accent. You suddenly you've lost your accent, because I remember you teaching me that no curry is good as your mummy's curry.
Yeah.
No, child. Every curry is different. Did you not know that?
So, that your mum's
he,
like
he loves. He loves the
That's
accent.
That's more like it.
He loves the accent.
And the little head.
The little head.
You've always got to turn your head like this, you know. Have you eaten?
Oh.
Have you not eaten? It doesn't matter. Here, have some dinner.
Oh, God.
So it's a similar thing. It's a funny cultural thing when it comes to Sri Lankans or anyone from that part of the world, really. It's all very motherly, and it's all very, you know, loving and all that sort of stuff. But of course, behind everyone else's backs, you know, nobody can really make a curry like your auntie or like your grandmother. You know, so it's always a little bit like that. But of course, I did mention while I was doing the cooking demo with Valerie that when people go, a lot of Sri Lankans will never turn down the opportunity to ever eat at another Sri Lankan's home for one main reason, because no two curries are alike and everyone cooks them differently. Mm. Even though the ingredients are the same, that the end result is always different.
Well, I've had great success buying fennel seed and using my little spice grinder to grind up fresh fennel powder, and it is an absolute eye-opener. And I've been using it when making lamb, like slow-cooked lamb curry with fennel powder, and it is delicious.
Well, of course, fennel is an important ingredient in all curry powders that people don't often recognise.
Ah.
So it is part of the curry flavour, you know. And getting back to just very quickly how you go and eat in another Sri Lankan household, you know, the first thing I always remember, as soon as we got back into the car, we were about to leave, my mother would say, "No, not as nice as my curry." You know, always compare privately in their heads how well that curry was to their own cooking. And I'm sure there's not one Sri Lankan lady out there that has never done that. I'm sure it's ingrained in their culture.
Now, at the end of your session, you gave me one of your own mixes of curry spices.
That's right.
What went into that? Because it tastes different. I mean, it's obviously curry, but it tastes different. What made it different?
Well, it's a traditional curry powder, which my cousin makes. I can't tell you all the ingredients in there, because there's a couple of things in there that she wants to keep
private. This is Valerie.
Yeah, but everything is organic and everything is herbal. So definitely there's, you know, the ground fennel seeds in there. There's cumin in there. There's a little bit of, not chili. She doesn't put chili in her curry powders, actually. A bit of turmeric in there as well.
Would you put salt in a curry?
No, you never put salt in a curry powder.
Okay.
No.
You'd add that, or
you
just
add your salt as you require to your own cooking.
With fish sauce or...
No, you can add it as salt.
Just salt, right.
But there's other things in there too, things like fenugreek, for instance, which is in there. There's cardamom in there as well, cloves, cinnamon, curry leaves that are all ground up and put in there as well. There's a couple of other things too that actually help to thicken the curry powder, help to thicken the curry gravy, so to speak, but more so than anything, infuse and hold the flavours in stasis so they don't just escape when you heat them up. So they're all placed in there. It's a traditional recipe that was passed down from my grandmother, then to my aunt, now to my cousin, and my cousin is now passing it down to her niece. So
there's some heavy-duty intellectual property
involved.
Yes,
and each one has tweaked it just a little. Just a little.
So it's an evolving family legacy.
Yeah, yeah. It's no major secret. It's just that she's learned how to perfect it. And, of course, it doesn't have to be used in a curry. It can be used with vegetables. It can be used with rice. Mm. It can be used in soups and stews just to add a little bit of extra flavour. And, of course, that's something that, we know, in the wintertime, making curries is always a delight.
I had some cauliflower last night, and I use some of my turmeric to flavour the rice, but I use your curry powder to actually make the curry around it with a little bit of coconut milk.
Mm.
And it was absolutely delicious because the cauliflower doesn't really compete with the spices that you had in your curry
powder.
It
just takes it on.
I could actually experience what it was really like. And it's interesting hearing you say what was in it, because I couldn't taste some of those things.
No. It just all amalgamates together and you get the end result, which is different. And you think, well, I can't really put my finger on those flavours, but my gosh, it tastes good. You can take it a step further and you can, something that Valerie doesn't do, and you can take that curry powder, for instance, and slow roast it in the oven so it darkens and intensifies even stronger. Mm. You can do it that way. And, of course, you can use it. I think it's lovely mixed with vegetables as well. And the coconut milk that you use, or the coconut cream, I think also brings a beautiful, beautiful familiarity to the whole thing. It just gels everything together.
Do you put sugar in Sri Lankan curries?
Never.
Ah.
Oh, goodness me, no. Ah. No, sugar. Mm.
Now, there's a distinct difference between Indian and Sri Lankan curries, isn't there?
There is a difference. And the curries change from country to country. And, you know, it all depends on how you like your curry. It's what you're more drawn to, I suppose. Yeah. And the Sri Lankans base a lot on vegetable dishes. It's not so dark or heavy. Many of the Indian curries are darker. We base our curries on coconut cream, coconut milk. There's a lot of that going on as well. So it's a little bit softer, more refined. But everything is different. And if you ever go to a Sri Lankan restaurant and you see things such as butter chicken on the menu, it's not a traditional Sri Lankan restaurant.
Righto.
They don't do butter chicken. Okay.
Okay.
Yes, look, I'd like to introduce a friend of mine, and I have to confess that I know the next person we're going to speak to. We're going to be speaking to Des Warnock, who's the Director of Plant of Health Fertilisers. And while I haven't met Des when I was working down at Sydney Botanic Gardens, I became a customer of his because he sells neem oil and also silica products. And at the Botanic Gardens, we were trying to find ways of controlling pests in things like the herb garden, where people were helping themselves to products, whether we'd sprayed them or not, whether we'd put signs out that these plants had been sprayed. So we were looking for organic remedies to problems, because we knew that whatever we said, people would use them. And Des' product was the one that we found had the best application, the most success in the garden. So this morning I would like to introduce Des Warnock from Plant of Health. Good morning, Des.
Hi, Des.
Hi, Des. Good morning, Jerry. Good morning, LJ. Good morning, Noel.
Now, Des, as the complete non-gardener of this team, in fact, the voice of death of the gardening show, I like to sort of put myself, what is neem oil?
Well, interesting product. Neem oil comes from a neem tree, which is a native tree of India and Asia. And it's been around for thousands and thousands of years, so I'm not new to it. I only came on board with neem about 20 years ago, but I'm probably a couple of thousand years behind everybody else. But it's a native tree there, and in India it's actually known as the village pharmacy, because every village has its neem tree.
Now, this plant has something like 22, 24 active ingredients in it?
Well, there's virtually thousands of molecules within the neem oil itself, which all act in very different ways. But there's some quite interesting web pages. I mean, if you Google neem, you'll come up with literally hundreds and thousands of web pages that describes what this tree does. But there's lots and lots of elements within the neem that gives lots and lots of properties. It's claimed to be antibacterial and antifungal, as well as being excellent soil conditioners and used throughout the world.
How did you come up across neem oil? What made you interested in distributing it to Australian gardeners?
Well, it was the whole ethos of what we were trying to achieve, because we were basically launching fertiliser products 20 years ago, and just because of our interest in health, or my interest in health, and myself and my business partner were naturally looking for the best type of products that we could sell, and neem was right up there that was used globally on a large scale for holistic gardening and for all types of agricultural use. So it was really a no-brainer once we started doing our studies into what neem properties had.
And well, one of the things that I found as a user of neem oil was that by using it on leafy vegetables, it discourages things, particularly cabbage white butterflies, from laying their eggs on vegetables that they would normally devastate. And the other use that I found was moving from Sydney to Brisbane. Grasshoppers are much more of a problem in a food garden, and spraying plants with the neem oil, that really did have an impact on the amount of losses to grasshoppers.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got to be a little bit careful in Australia and what we can claim and what we can't claim because of our laws governing chemicals, which we're glad that they're out there because it helps protect people from all sorts of things being sold to us. So, but neem oil in its natural state has lots and lots of properties. And one of the things that convinced me years ago was a TV show on SBS called The Nature of Things, where Dr. David Suzuki, the famous environmentalist, did a show called What's in a Neem? And it was really interesting to see the different studies that were being done around the world with all sorts of properties that neem can do. And once again, the more we looked into it, the more we realised that we had to bring this oil to Australia and to help promote it throughout the gardeners for the benefits that neem does.
Does anybody actually grow neem? Can you buy Australian-grown neem oil?
I'm not too sure. There was a large push around about probably 10 or 15 years ago to commercially grow neem trees in northern Australia. One of the issues with that, I believe, at the time was that the neems actually became weeds in that section of Australia because they would self-propagate. Yeah.
Right.
And so there was issues with that in that regard. But I've got a neem tree in my backyard because you can still commercially buy neem trees locally. And I think Brisbane is probably about the lowest you could grow them. They don't self-propagate here. They're extremely slow-growing. And, you can have them in your backyard, as I believe, in this area.
Now, the other product that you offer is silica. Now, as a gardener, I know that bamboo blunts pruning equipment because it has so much silica in the stems, and that the mulch that comes from bamboo leaves is a great way of putting silica around the garden, and that silica is an important structural element in the tissue of plants. So if they don't have enough of it, they're not strong, they're not resilient plants. How did you come about selling that particular product?
I love silica. It's one of my favourite products, and it's the most, you know, even after 15 years, there's very little understanding of it in the market and what it actually does. But I can tell you now that I use silica in virtually every one of our fertiliser programs I do commercially, and I still encourage it, people to use it even domestically. Once again, it was a case of doing my soil nutrition and plant nutrition studies. It got back to thinking outside of the conventional way of the disease model of plants, meaning, thinking what do we do to plants when they have pest problems or bug problems. My thought patterns are, why are these plants stressing? So my whole focus in regards to what we do at Plant of Health is to have healthy soil and healthy plants, and silica is absolutely essential in having optimum health and strength to most plants in the market, you know.
It's quite right. You say there's a lack of knowledge out there in the public, and I think if I was to go and speak to gardeners at an expo, they probably wouldn't even know what silica was, let alone what its role is in plant health. But it's really important. I think the thing that you've said with both of these products is that if you provide healthy growing conditions for a plant, then they don't succumb to diseases. They don't become they become more pest resistant as well. So how do you go about encouraging people to use these products? How do you encourage uptake?
Well, I guess at the end of the day, I mean, people get bombarded with clever advertising. So I can understand that people would be very confused on what products to use and what not to use. Our best method is through education and simply sticking with our core values in regards to only selling products that increase soil and plant fertility, for one thing. But I think there's a little bit of understanding in regards to things like silica. I see a lot of those women's encyclopedias like New Idea, and I'm probably a bit out of context here, but things like Women's Day, they're selling silica capsules now that people are taking orally. And because silica accumulates in things like fingernails and hair and teeth and connecting tissue, and it makes these areas very, very tough. The same sort of things happen in plants. It deposits in the skin of the epidermis of the plant, makes them really, really tough. And when you get tough plants, you get maximum pest resistance, maximum fungal resistance, disease resistance, better photosynthesis, and everyone wins out of it in that regard.
Now, if people are interested in following up leads and discovering more about neem oil and silica products, how do they find you, Des?
Well, they can go to our website, which is plantofhealth.com.au, which we have some wonderful articles on there as well. And basically look for us at any decent independent nursery. I noticed since a lot of the nurseries or independent nurseries have closed down, a lot of the talented horticulturists are now condensed into the ones that are remaining. So you can get some really, really good information at your nurseries, your independent nurseries, and you'll find a lot of our products are stocked where the educated nursery men are.
Des Warnock, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you also for reminding us about the importance of independent retailers in the nursery industry.
A pleasure. Thanks, Jerry.
So, boys, let's look at some more questions from the listeners.
I got an interesting inquiry from Renee in Cairns, and this was through Facebook, and she's complaining that her bananas are not tasting good.
Ah.
And, well, look, I think that the thing we have to remember is that even if you're living in the tropics and bananas are tropical plants, you're going through winter. And when you go through a slightly cooler conditions, the metabolism of the plants adjust. And that may mean that they won't take up quite as many nutrients as they need. The fruit may not be quite so good. And fruit that ripen out of season are often called November bunch, which means that they may not have the full shape, the normal shape, the full size or the full flavour. And those are things a commercial grower would just cut off and throw away. They would never sell them. But being home gardeners, we tend to eat everything. And so all I've basically said to Renee is that in wintertime, the only thing that I would give my bananas is a handful of gypsum, and that provides calcium, which is important for their health. And for the rest of the year, so spring, summer and autumn, I feed my bananas every single month. And each flowering stem, anything that's going to carry fruit, that will get a handful of poultry manure. I water them daily in dry weather, so a bucket of water per stem, per plant, in dry weather, and I give them seaweed solution. They get that watered in when they are watered, and once a fortnight. So they get a regular rhythmic supply of nutrients. Bananas are quite hungry, and they'll take everything that you give them. Giving them compost is great for a mulch, but it's not going to provide the nourishment you need to produce full quality, full flavoured plants. Now, the poultry manure contains potassium, and potassium is very important for encouraging the sugar levels in the fruit to develop, and I think that is probably the thing she's missing most in her fruit.
I would say that's absolutely right there, Jerry. I've got another one here. This is from Denise in Southport. Hi, Noel. I've seen a lot of flowering cherries available for sale at the local shops. I won't say where she saw them lately and was considering getting one for a feature in the front yard, yet haven't seen any in anyone else's gardens. Will they grow here? Should I try anyway? You know, I've seen them as well. They're very expensive acquisitions to just try because they're nothing less than about $100 anyway to buy, because you see them as weeping standard forms. That's the ones that have been brought out. Now, Denise, I have to say that this is not really the climate for flowering cherries. They do need a very long, extended, cold, chilling period that often starts in the southern states by the end of March and continues right through until sometimes early September. And that's when you'll start to see the cherries flowering. That triggers the flowering on many of the cherries from around late September into October, and they are an absolute delightful sight. And I think most people get just caught up with the romanticism of having a flowering cherry in their front yard.
Absolutely.
And I just have to say, I find it very deceiving when stores deliberately go out of their way to stock products like these for gardeners here in southeast Queensland. It's very distressing because people aren't spending a little amount of money, they're spending a lot of money. There is, however, an opportunity for you to go for a different form of plant, and that is a relative of the flowering cherry, which is the Taiwanese cherry. And that form is Prunus campanulata. It is naturally from a lower altitude and, of course, can take southeast Queensland winters, which are relatively mild, and will still flower for you. And they normally flower from now until late August, and they're a real delight to see. They're single little flowers, and they only grow to between 3 and 4 metres tall, so they're not a big plant. But again, something that you put into a small little shady corner or protected spot, and you can get many, many years of enjoyment out of them. I've got one in my own garden.
No, but the big question is, does it have fruit?
No. These are flowering cherries.
Oh,
these are ornamental flowering cherries.
Oh.
So these are grown predominantly for their flowering attributes. Very, very prolific. Very pretty. Things that you see in chocolate box covers.
Yeah, I know what you mean. The sort of the Japanese paintings
and
things.
Yes, absolutely. So people go for the Japanese cherry blossom festivals, and that's what it's all about. They're not fruiting. They're just purely for the flowers.
Ah, I see. Mm. And, Jerry, you said you had another short question.
Yes. I've got an inquiry from Ashley in the Gold Coast hinterland, and he's a regular Facebook fan, and he said he's been trying to propagate pentas. Another question about pentas, but he's been trying to propagate them by cuttings. He took cuttings in winter, put them into pots, covered the pots with plastic bags, and the cuttings are wilting as soon as he takes the bags off, and they're dropping their leaves inside the bag. So what I've suggested is this, and it's a simple rule. Pentas are a warm season plant. They grow actively in warmer weather. And when they grow in the warm seasons, they also root more efficiently. So if he waits until, say, October time and then takes cuttings, you'll find that they will root quite quickly. I don't like putting plastic bags over cuttings because if you get a lot of humidity building up and the leaves are in contact with that moisture, they can rot, and sometimes you'll find that will cause the leaves to drop. So what do you do to conserve moisture around the cuttings while they're growing through the rooting process? I find a PET bottle, a recycled bottle, just cut the bottom off, and I unscrew the cap, generally speaking. I'll unscrew the cap and put that over the cuttings so it's a rigid structure. It provides a little bit of movement in there, that little cap at the top, so you don't get that risk of mould and fungi building up. And generally speaking, they will root within 3 weeks of striking cuttings if you do it, say, from October onwards.
Mm. All right. And now, boys. Oh, sorry, Noel, did you have something
else? I've got one last one.
Carry on.
I did. David from Kamira. He's been trying to grow asparagus since the end of last year, but can't seem to get any thick stems. And he wants to know if he's doing something wrong. He's heard me mention about asparagus on the air before. and just wants to know what is he doing wrong and can he keep going with it, or do they actually grow here in Southeast Queensland? Well, David, yes, they do grow here. I've got asparagus growing at home. My neighbours have had asparagus for over 30 years in their vegetable garden. The trick with asparagus, and I wish everybody could have a bottle of this when they buy a packet or a pot of asparagus, is a nice bottle of patience, because what they take is up to 3 years to develop their mature size crown, which in turn will then provide you with the thicker spears. Now, within 6 to 8 months of planting asparagus, you're not going to get asparagus to grow successfully or to grow into any edible size plant in your garden. So the idea is you have to wait. The other thing with asparagus, they love their food. They love their compost-rich soil. So if you haven't put anything into the soil, now's the time to lift them up very quickly, add all the goodness into the soil and plant them on a slight mound with their roots either side, and then cover them up. Asparagus are one of the longest lived edible plants in a vegetable garden, and they look really quite nice, but they look a bit messy sometimes. So the idea is let them go to foliage in the summertime, leave them alone, forget about them. That actually in turn will help to mature that crown, let that foliage die down the following autumn and winter time. That'll happen 2 to 3 seasons in a row, and then you'll start to get asparagus spears the size or the thickness of your finger, or your little finger at least.
So they're the elephant of the garden.
They are, and they're
slow
the most,
and steady.
No asparagus from my garden ever reaches the kitchen.
Oh, because they're yummy fresh.
They're incredibly beautiful when they're freshly picked.
Lovely.
All right, so our nursery of the week this week is a great little nursery on the north side of Brisbane, LJ. And this is a wonderful little nursery that I came across about a year or so ago. And prior to that, they used to have a wholesale nursery business. And we're speaking to Kathy Richards, who was one of the directors of Garden Gem Nurseries. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning, good morning. Thanks for calling me.
You're speaking to Jerry, LJ and Noel.
Hi, Kathy.
How are you going?
Hello, good morning. Good morning to you all. Good, thank you.
Kathy, the reason we're speaking to you, of course, because we want to sort of let people know a little bit about your nursery, where you are and what you do and what makes you stand out.
Well, we're a small family-owned business in Morayfield, and I think we're quite unique in that we family run and own, and we are able and we try very hard to source different things and lovely orchids, and we try and be a little bit special, and we understand the demographic of our area very well too.
Yes, okay, so you specialise in orchids, and I have to say, guys, I've actually witnessed this myself. I would have to say you do have, I would say, Brisbane's largest selection of potted orchids for people to buy.
Yes, we do. I work very hard at that, trying to source them and really trying to get good orchids at good prices for people.
So, Kathy, I can say this, I can vouch for this, guys, because I have seen the most incredible array of orchids available in this nursery. And because of that, I really would have to put my hand up and say they would have to have the largest selection I have ever seen in a small retail nursery. Isn't that right, Kathy?
Yes, well, we've become quite well known, I think, for our orchids. So I work very hard at getting a good selection in and keeping them good and healthy and happy all the time. And yeah, we do have quite a large selection, I must say.
I know. This is great for a lot of orchid enthusiasts. Now, what else do you have in the nursery that is a little bit different?
Well, I can't. It's hard to think of a plant at the moment because, you know, I try and go for, instead of just the normal everyday little plants that you know, that you see around, I look around for different things. So there can be different things at different times. You know, it depends what's available.
Well, that is something that I've noticed about your nursery, Kathy. You do tend to take that extra step to guarantee that you are offering different and unusual plants for a lot of your clientele as well. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the activities that you may have for the nursery?
Well, what we do in the nursery, what I try and do is run workshops where I get guest speakers and people who are really in the know to come and teach people about gardening and their plants and different things. And we try and do that a few times a year. And I think that's very interesting and appreciated by my customers.
And Kathy, where do you find the different plants that you find? How, what's the process of research to find them?
Well, what I do is, especially if I have requests for plants, of course I use the internet like other people do, but I do know quite a lot of people, private, perhaps not commercial growers, but people who've been in the industry for a long time and who grow different things. So if I get a name of a plant somebody wants, I will really start asking around. People who've been in the industry for a long time, I ask them where they've seen it, where they've heard from it. Through the garden clubs, many people have different things and I try and source it through them. It's amazing what people know about bits and pieces if you start looking, you know?
That's right. So you have to dig to find. That's absolutely right. Kathy, can you tell everyone where you are situated and your opening hours?
We're at 570 Moray Field Road, Burton Garry. We're open 7 days a week from 8:30 to 4:30.
And do you have a website?
Yes. I don't know it well, Noel.
That's okay. So if people look up Under Garden Gems in the Google search engine, I'm sure they'll find it.
Under Garden Gems Nursery. Sorry, I don't take care of that sort of thing. And I'm too busy working in the nursery.
Good to know. Kathy, look, it's been delightful having you today as part of our podcast. And I hope you've enjoyed yourself. And I'm sure that you're going to get a lot of new customers into your store as well. It is a delightful place to visit. And on the north side, it's always a wonderful drive to get out there. Thank you, Kathy, for your time. It's been great.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye.
Wow, she sounds like a really hard worker, doesn't she?
And with the power of the internet, I've found that their website is www.gardengems.com.au.
Oh, that's so difficult to remember. But she is a very hard worker.
Oh, you can tell.
Yeah.
7 days a week, all day, in and out,
yeah.
New plants. She never 8:30 stops.
8:30 start, that's early for a garden centre, isn't it? All year round.
For most of the time, yes, it is, yeah.
So, boys, it's time to talk about what's happening in your garden and what people should be working on now for the future.
Well, the important thing is for me is seed saving. And so at the moment I'm identifying some of my winter crops, the best plants, and tagging them or just making sure that nobody else picks them so that they can then go to seed in spring. I'm also sowing some late winter crops, and I've been waiting for the chance to do this because I have had a lot of weeding to do, but I've been putting in radicchio, radish and turnips to get a quick crop from those. I've some second sowings of lettuce. I'm running out of Italian parsley, so I've planted some seedlings and I've sowed some seed. Mm-hmm. I'm putting in some flowering turnip again because my first crop went very, very quickly. That was eaten, and it's such a delicious vegetable. The flowering turnip seed, the only source that I know of for this is Franchi seed, which sell online. And I've not found anybody else that sells them, but generic things like turnips, pretty easy to get. But Golden Globe is probably my favourite because it stores so well in the ground. Some turnips go off, but Golden Globe is the best, the most durable of the lot. And as for radishes, French breakfast is my favourite. I've tried a whole range of other ones, things like icicle. They're appealing because they look like white carrots. But the thing that I hate is when you're actually picking them and preparing them for the pot, things like white icicle, they have wispy little hairs, right, roots all the way along the stem, and removing those is really irritating, whereas French breakfast and saxifrage and sparkler, which is another lovely bright red sort of radish, they don't have any of these wispy little hairs, so you just top and tail them, put them in the pot and cook them, or you just dice them and they go straight into a salad.
Yeah, beautiful. Mm.
Now, for those with brassicas still in their garden, they mm-hmm. need to sort of make sure they can protect them from the onslaught of cabbage white butterfly if they haven't been attacked already. Mm. So for those with the latter part, I've still got brassicas growing in my garden. They've developed a little slower for me this year, but you might need to look at doing some precautionary tactics there. So covering them up with a netting is also a good way of keeping the white butterflies physically off the plants. It won't do much harm for the actual plant development at all. You can use certain sprays, the neem sprays we talked about earlier as well, if the caterpillars always happen to be there. And towards the latter part of the brassica season, as we get closer towards the middle of spring, let the last of those just simply go to flower for many reasons, for a couple of reasons in particular. One reason being is they bring the most incredible array of bees to the garden. They're a wonderful fodder source for bees. And, of course, that means you'll also get a great amount of seed occurring from those as well that you can collect and sow the following growing season. This is a good time for putting in things such as sunflowers for flowering towards the latter part of spring, early summer. They take about 100 days between the time of planting until the time they actually are in flower. And, of course, having things flowering when it starts to get really hot really lifts up the spirit. So never think about what's happening right now. Think about the future for those sorts of things. So you can plant a lot of those things. The cosmos, you can plant the sunflowers. Kids love all those things, and get the kids to plant them.
There you go. There's a bit of good life advice from Noel Burdett. Think about the future, get organised and get it in the ground. Well, it's lovely to spend time with you, my two good gardening mates, and we'll talk again in August.
Yes. Thank you, LJ.
Pleasure.
Bye for now.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks, Noel.